Welcome to The Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast in which all the presidents are indicted by truth bombs. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, gang.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
That's right. So you may have heard the news on Thursday. Former President Donald J. Trump was indicted in federal court on 37 counts related to what prosecutors contend is the deliberate concealment and rather careless storage of more than 100 illegally possessed national security documents that the National Archives and Department of Justice had repeatedly asked him to hand over, including under subpoena. Said documents allegedly included sensitive information about defensive capabilities and vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies, including nuclear programs, as well as various scenarios for military conflict. On two occasions, the subpoena rather convincingly lays out, Trump shared such documents with visitors not authorized to see them while making comments that seemed to acknowledge his awareness that he was doing a no-no. This is the first time an ex-president of these United States has been indicted in federal court, though it may not be the last, what with Special Prosecutor Jack Smith still looking into Trump's attempts to influence the results of the November 2020 election. The 45th president's supporters, most Republicans in Congress, and many of his competitors for the 2024 GOP nomination have decried the weaponization of the DOJ and the unequal treatment of, for example, former Secretary of State and 2016 presidential nominee Hillary Clinton for the way she mishandled classified documents at her private residence. But there have also been a sprinkling of conservatives who've described the indictment as damning, including a former Trump Attorney General William Barr. That's Nick Gillespie's favorite. Senator Mitt Romney, Suderman's favorite. Longshot presidential candidate Chris Christie and a handful of writers over at National Review. Catherine, when we previously visited the Mar-a-Lago documents on this here podcast, our critique about the law enforcement side of it, centered on the skeevy use of the Espionage Act, the routine overclassification of everything, and the possibility that Trump maybe didn't know what is or isn't legal because he's Donald Trump. How does the indictment alter those critiques in particular, if at all?
Well, I suppose that last one is the main thing, since there does seem to be oddly copious evidence that he absolutely knew he wasn't supposed to have these documents and kept them anyway, and then repeatedly consulted lawyers about whether, even though he knew he had the documents he wasn't supposed to have, he could maybe just like lie to the FBI about that. So that charitable theory that we had advanced, the classic Hanlon's razor incompetence over conspiracy theory, not looking great right now. I think we're going to have to go with at least a conspiracy of kind of one guy, a couple of half-hearted lawyers who also took a lot of notes, and that like body man fella who's named on the indictments as well. I will say I enjoyed Donald Trump's quotes from March when he said, I used to think that attorneys had a really high status in life, that when you had an attorney, that attorneys can't be subpoenaed. Because the other thing that has, you know, it, sort of in the category of, hey, we don't love the overclassification of documents, and hey, we don't love the use of the Espionage Act for things that are really fall short of like straight up high treason type stuff. Also at play now is the crime fraud exception, which is the provision of the law that allows prosecutors to work around attorney-client privilege. And so that has turned out to be a huge part of this case. Don't love that either, frankly. So I think that is another one on our list of, to me, I can see why people who support Donald Trump remain kind of convinced that this is politically motivated and that he is in some ways being treated worse than other people in the criminal justice system. I think it can also be true that he did the bad thing. But it is troubling to see all of these different provisions of law brought to bear at the same time when they violate our sense of fairness and how the justice system should work.
Nick, both Justin Amash, former representative, and your
future president of the United States.
Future president. And then future super president, Eli Lake, have critiqued and just been flat out against the use of the Espionage Act in this case, as I think maybe we all might be, or in some degrees, we all don't like the Espionage Act. Let's say that. It's a Woodrow Wilson gizna, and it can't be
you
good.
You know, and it's shame because I like everything else from Woodrow Wilson except the Espionage Act.
Let me query you this, Dr. Gillespie. Throw away the Espionage Act for a second. Should the underlying conduct of Trump as alleged by prosecution, let's all remember when we're hearing about this, an indictment is kind of the best case forward, or at least a convincing case forward by one side in something that they had a lot of subpoena power to cobble together. But should the underlying behavior of, hey, there's a subpoena for these things that are illegal for me to have, yeah, I'm not going to follow it. I'm going to tell my lawyers how to not, and my lackeys to not follow it. We're going to move the boxes over here, especially in the little toilet room, and then lie about it. Should that conduct be illegal? Should there be a punishment for that conduct if indeed he engaged in it?
Yes. I thank you for that question. And, you know, if you don't use the Espionage Act, you could use the Presidential Records Act or a couple of other things to deal with this. Absolutely, there should be some kind of punishment. Should there be 20 years in jail? Probably not. There should be a full public airing of the hilarity and ridiculousness and pathetic nature of it. What I read the indictment as Matt instructed us all to do, and my favorite parts were where the various bellhops and stuff like that at Mar-a-Lago are like, oh, well, we'll put him on the stage of the ballroom, and then it's like, okay, let's move him into the bathroom and things like that. And I'm sure we all have friends like this. Maybe we are that friend who, when you go to, you know, they have you over for dinner, and you go into the bathroom, to use it, and you realize they have luggage or boxes in the bathtub.
I feel seen.
And you're like, I was going to go into the prescription, into the drug cabinet to see what kind of prescription drugs they have, but I'm mesmerized. Like, is the luggage full or empty or whatever? But
I also think if they have luggage in the bathtub, the odds that the prescription drugs in the cabinet are expired is like 100%.
Yeah. But it's,
but those expiration dates are fake. We know that.
Yeah, they are.
You can still take those drugs.
Big Pharma. You know, I want to drag this conversation to Big Pharma, which is what we really should be talking about. But the overlap of people who are saying this is a terrible prosecution, Trump conservatives who are like, the president gets to do whatever he wants, although they hated, having a unified president or a president with unchecked authority. If it's Obama or Biden, or who say, well, the reason why blacks get arrested at such higher levels is because they cause more crime. It's like Trump is being treated differently because he acted much differently than Biden or Mike Pence or even Hillary Clinton. And we'll recall, when people are like, how dare you do this to a president or whatever? These are the same people who are chanting and still chant, lock her up. At every given, possibility. So we should deal with that. And that is even incorporating the fact that the espionage shouldn't exist. And it might not, maybe not even be used in this case and things like that. But Trump is on the horns of this dilemma because he acted poorly. It's not about overclassification. And it's not about anything other than Trump being a complete idiot and let his people deal with that.
Peter, is there validity, even like partial validity in the widely repeated critique that we are seeing a case of unequal justice here, that you don't have to call the deep state necessarily, but just that the wheels of government aided on by the kind of obvious bias of the news media and sort of the political culture is tilted preponderantly against Trump in particular, but against Republicans and people right of center, as partially evidenced by the unequal treatment of Hillary Clinton.
So I think that's partially true, but it's partially true because in part because Trump has invited that sort of treatment. He has benefited from it. He has played into it. He wants the media to hate him. I mean, did you see the CNN town hall that he did with Caitlin Collins a month ago? The guy was in hog heaven because he was being treated like the, you know, like a reckless, narcissistic, lying jackass, right? And he was just like, yeah, it's great. And you're a nasty woman. And like, and so there is an element in which, you know, there's a way of looking at this in which, of course, it's true that the media and sort of the deep state, the bureaucracy, hate him. But Trump has fed that hatred intentionally. And he's also just walked into this in a way that is almost comical. So, I mean, it's more than comical. Nick's favorite passages were the bits where Trump is like texting with his lackeys, or the lackeys are texting each other about where to move the boxes. My favorite page of this indictment is page 9, sections 22 and 23. The headline on these two sections are Trump's public statements on classified information. And it just lists out all the stuff that Trump said in 2016 about how incredibly important it is for the president to protect classified information and not be above the law. So here's like a sample. In my administration, I'm going to enforce all laws concerning the protection of classified information. No one will be above the law. That's August 2016.
Hang on, hang on. It's really important. Was that your Trump impersonation?
Yeah, it was.
No.
Yeah,
it was. Wow. Was just
that
like voice?
Baron? Is that Baron Trump?
Yeah. And then there's like a whole like official presidential statement from 2018. As head of the executive branch and commander in chief, I have a unique constitutional responsibility to protect the nation's classified information, including by controlling access to it. And then they blah, 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 a bunch of stuff. And it ends with any access granted to our nation's secrets should be in furtherance of national, not personal interests. And then, of course, he spent a couple of years like not controlling access to the secrets entirely for personal interests, because the guy wanted to show off that he had like the nuclear codes or whatever to Kid Rock. And if you do that, especially after the records agencies in the government are like, OK, you need to give the boxes back. OK, we're going to work with your lawyer. Give the boxes back. OK. Your lawyer said you gave all the boxes back, and then we found out that you didn't give all the boxes back, and we've got you on tape telling your lawyer, maybe we should kind of lie about this. Could we lie? What do you expect to happen?
Catherine, I think it's appropriate here to give credit to C.J. Sharamela's, I don't know how to pronounce his name, my boxes theory.
Yeah. The other piece of this that I keep thinking about, and this is like the worst possible analysis, but I'm just going to offer it here on our podcast that we do. Donald Trump is like a dude that had a little too much weed in a state where weed is still illegal and is getting charged with intent to deal when he was really going to consume it all himself. Like the Espionage Act implies that was like going to do something with these documents, that he was going to give them to a foreign power or disseminate them or leak them or something. And I think obviously it's Donald Trump, so we have no idea what he was going to do, but probably he just had them. And then he was like, oh, I have them. And then he had too many of them and he kind of panicked. But I feel like he's getting charged with intent to deal when in fact he probably should have just been charged with possession.
Well,
he was going to use them to impress E. Jean Carroll. I think.
Maybe he was going to smoke them. Like, I don't know. I don't
too
know.
Too soon.
So I heard a story about somebody who had a connection to Donald Trump back when he was in private business in the 80s and 90s. And the person was like,
that sounds
Donald
really
Trump was
important.
Was completely impossible to deal with, because you'd go into his office and you'd want to talk about whatever building you were working on or business deal, and Trump could not focus on the work because all he wanted to do was like pull magazine covers off the wall and show you pictures of him and talk about like whether he liked the article or not and like the awards he'd gotten, and just like couldn't focus on anything because he's just obsessed with all of the the kind of the narcissistic memorabilia, right? Like the stuff about him, he can't stop thinking about that. And in fact, that sounds a lot like the Trump that we saw reported on in the White House when he was in the Oval Office. And he just spent all day watching cable news, obsessing about what people were saying about him on cable news.
You know, the one thing I'll add, Matt Welch, just to your perpetual consternation, though, is that the more that we just talk about Trump in this, I think we are missing a bigger and more important picture, which is people are right to, on some broad level, doubt the veracity and the validity of the Department of Justice, which has been heavily politicized, not just under Biden, but under Trump and under Obama and under George Bush and presidents before that. And that, you know, both sides here, not to do complete whataboutism, but, you know, it's not just Donald Trump who fails to inspire confidence or trust from people other than his most loyal, you know, bootlickers. It's also Joe Biden and the federal government and the political system and DC properly. And that the big outcome of this, it doesn't really matter if Trump, you know, I mean, literally, it doesn't matter if he gets convicted or not, because he could still run for president and could still win. The real outcome is that we are going to come out of this with people on both sides feeling less trust and less confidence in, you know, the government and in major institutions. And until these parties really clean up their worst actors, this is just one more conversation in a continuing, you know, slow then fast then slow again descent into complete nihilism, I think.
But Trump is a major contributor to the.
Yeah, I'm not saying he isn't. Yeah. I'm not saying he isn't. What I'm saying, he's also the effect of it. And, you know, the fact is that if, you know, to be quite honest, if Hillary Clinton, not to pin everything on her, but if Hillary Clinton hadn't been such a complete bullshit artist as a politician, we would be laughing about Donald Trump getting 20% in the 2016 election.
Hillary Clinton, did not apologize or admit any wrongdoing in how she handled her private server and her private access and unsecured access to sensitive State Department stuff for 6 months after the New York Times first published an article about that in March of 2015, and just repeatedly lied and dissembled about it. We will for sure link to some of Jacob Sullivan's very apt coverage on that. And to further the comparison, Peter, since you understand about the computers so well, if we look at the comparative conduct and just simply from the perspective of what is the biggest vulnerability, comparative vulnerability to access to national, or the, you know, injury to national security offered by Hillary Clinton having a private email server over here, and Donald Trump having some red folders in a bunch of boxes in his toilet at Mar-a-Lago over here. What is actually the biggest threat to national security in that scenario? Is it the physical location in a place that's sloppily handled, or the stuff that can be accessed from the ether, perhaps?
So this is a good question, and in some ways, it's the one that, you know, that is going to be used to, I think, to kind of muddle the issue here, which is...
I'm not like, muddling the issue, Peter Sudermann. I'll ask you a question.
Yeah, I understand it. I'm trying to answer because I think what Clinton did does not in any way excuse what Trump did or didn't, right? Like, whatever Clinton did, it just is irrelevant to whether Trump... you know, committed a crime or what, like how bad it was. Like, we don't judge these things on a relative basis. Yes, of course, we end up doing that, but the law should not be about judging things on a relative basis. And if it was a mistake to not prosecute Hillary Clinton, if it was, you know, an error in legal reasoning there, then that was a separate error. And I think it's actually worth keeping these things separate and not saying that, well, because of whatever happened with Clinton, that like that changes what is going on with Trump. No, Trump did what he did. The law is what it is. And Trump said what he said. And that is, and it's like, it's, these are two different things. And trying to say, well, we're just going to judge these like entirely on a bell curve, you know, and it's going to be, it's not that there is a right and a wrong. There's a right and a wrong in each case. And you can judge them independently without without focusing on the facts of the other.
Yeah, but
and we didn't go after Hillary Clinton. And I wrote repeatedly about how she was a liar, about how she was degrading trust in herself and the institution, about how she had done things that were at bare minimum, raised huge questions about her ability to act with good judgment as commander in chief and as president. I repeatedly about that. And I think the same is true about Donald Trump. In both cases, these people who are at the absolute top of our political system displayed incredibly poor judgment. And just because the legal system ended up treating one person differently than the other does not mean that it's not bad in both cases.
Yeah, but it does mean that, like, so did you write that Hillary should have been indicted and sentenced, you know, et cetera?
I mean, because that's I don't believe I've actually written that about.
So then you should be saying that Donald Trump is an idiot, but should not be indicted. Right. I mean, if we're doing, you know, parallelisms here. And again, for me, ultimately, you know, what this whole flap and unbelievably, it's not even nearly being over. Is that, you know, what we end up in, we're still stuck with talking about the two worst presidential candidates in American history. Only one of them got to be president, which is a good thing. But like, we are stuck with these, you know, old, you know, flotsam and jetsam from the 20th century. I mean, Hillary Clinton, you know, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, et cetera. And until we figure out a way to get past these two, you know, intestinal blockages, we're not going to have a country that is, you know, is going to start, or at least the politics in this country aren't going to get better and better.
I think there's probably been worse presidential candidates in American history. Didn't Aaron Burr
than
run
Donald
for president?
Trump?
If Aaron Burr ran for president, I'm going to call him worse. Let alone Woodrow.
Lin-Manuel
Miranda on his
read Gore Vidal's Burr, and you would wish to live in that timeline, you know, where Aaron Burr was actually president.
Just to build on and dispute Peter's points about the law is the law. James Comey, well, first of all, the law is an ass. And second of all, we have so much criminalization that it puts all this power in the discretion of prosecutors. And James Comey's press conference, I think just one, but maybe two or three during the 2016 campaign, I've blacked it all out, along with my knowledge of Aaron Burr's candidacies over the years. Laid out basically that Hillary Clinton broke the law, but he articulated a standard. And the standard is, and this is a quote, they're looking for clearly intentional and willful mishandling of classified information or vast quantities of materials exposed in such a way as to support an inference of intentional misconduct or indications of disloyalty to the United States or efforts to obstruct justice. End quote. That was the standard. He said that this prosecution for Clinton, or the imagined prosecution for Clinton, failed to meet those standards. Catherine, putting you on the spot, do you think the Comey standards, as articulated there, lend credence to the idea that you should prosecute Trump, even though you shouldn't prosecute Hillary Clinton?
I think that it's all. There is no like truth that is mooring this conversation. I think that it is all politics. I think that it is all specifics, right? And that those are two different things. So there is, in theory, a single principle that would say prosecute Clinton and not Trump. And you could also craft a principle that would reverse those based on what I think you were hinting at in your question before of like, well, maybe the Ruskies can get Hillary's stuff on the internet. And it would take a very specific person to get that one box out of the golden bathroom. And so I think there's you know, there's a case to be made in both directions. Again, the kind of place that I wash, the shore that I wash up on is no Espionage Act. We'll just leave that out of it. None of this is, whatever this is, it's carelessness, it's sloppiness, it's, you know, bureaucratic rules violations. It is not, it should not be the subject of espionage type charges. And then after that, yeah, I think it's literally just like who has the keys to the car at any given time. And we should just accept that that's how it is, that it's a war of all against all. And try to
accepted?
Have
Shouldn't we rage incessantly?
Obviously, I'm mid rage, Nick. I'm in the middle of the raging, but right. But it's that's we should acknowledge it.
Let's get just a lightning round yes no question, which I imagine you guys might expand a
this
little bit.
This is like not we can never this. Do a lightning round.
We can do it.
We'll
I believe
try.
In us
we'll
today.
We'll try.
If Lightning McQueen. Found guilty, prison, yes or no, Nick Gillespie?
No.
Catherine?
No.
Peter?
I don't think he should go to prison. However, however, by Trump's own standards,
by Trump's own standards,
he should.
Thank God Trump's standards don't set the standard for whether or not people go to prison.
Well, he was the president and is trying to be again, and so his standards do matter when it
they
comes
do matter,
to the law.
But he's not the boss of us. No, right
we live in a world of laws, not of men, right?
It's so many men in this world. Jesus.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and Hillary.
My answer is no. I don't think people should go to prison for stuff like this. I want to, we haven't really talked about some of the kind of GOP backbencher Olympics of how to say the craziest things. Does anyone have an example that they particularly enjoy of some of the efforts that various low-ranking Republican congressmen especially have made in order to justify this behavior? Peter?
If you give me a second to pull these.
Catherine,
God damn it.
It's fine. It's fine.
Nick wants to go.
This.
Let Nick go.
Mr. Cotter. Mr. Cotter.
Horseshack. Go.
Yeah. Mike Lee, who's not a minor person, put out this big statement on Twitter about how the Biden administration's actions can only be compared to the type of oppressive tactics routinely seen in nations such as Venezuela, Bolivia, and Nicaragua.
Only is a key word
only.
There. Only.
No, and it's like, you know, Mike Lee has made, he's beclowned himself. You know, during the, you know, he's a Tea Party guy who talked a lot about cutting, you know, the size, scope, and spending of government, you know, particularly under Obama, and even started a project that was said, bring things back to constitutional, blah, blah, blah. And he is just incredibly, indelibly partisan in all of his stuff. And I find that very dispiriting.
Peter, did you find
so there were a bunch? Yeah. So there were a bunch of Republicans who, you know, were really mad about this and were like, this is war. And that's obviously bad. But I thought it was notable how few of them actually attempted to defend Trump on the merits. They were just like the argument was almost entirely, well, this is just political and therefore we should, it's bad, but almost none of them attempted to say, well, what Trump did was okay. The closest I think I saw was Jim Jordan, who went on CNN, and his position was that it was okay because Trump declassified the documents before he left office. The problem with this is that Trump is on tape saying, I didn't declassify the documents before I left office. And so the best defense of Trump is to lie about what Trump did, or at least the most substantive.
Catherine, do you have a favorite example of a backbencher, probably? Mike Lee is no backbencher, by the way, but of a Republican elected official saying something cuckoo bananas in the wake of Trump's 37 count indictment.
So, I don't know. Is Lindsey Graham a backbencher?
No, not anymore. I mean,
he's
I guess
the front
just
bench.
Elected.
He's the benchiest bench.
It's a short
what about,
bench.
But what about Hutchison? Can we talk about...
Do it.
Asa. So, he has been out there kind of... I don't know. He's doing the, like, innocent until proven guilty thing, right? So he's saying... the indictment is bad for our country, bad for the presidency, and is a legitimate campaign issue. We do not need to have our commander in chief of this country not protecting our nation's secrets. Which, if you see that quote just in isolation, you have no idea which side he's on, right? Like, it's like, yeah, it is bad to not have the commander in chief protecting our nation's secrets, but like, this one didn't, right? Or are we, is he claiming that the bathroom documents were the protection? Anyway, I think we are entering the motivated reasoning season. We are entering the season in which whichever tribe you were a part of, you just begin to defend the actions of the leader of that tribe. And Hutchison really seems to be part of that crew.
Yeah. That's really new. I'm just like, I've never seen anyone do that in politics before. It's kind of crazy.
I mean, there's sarcasm. An uptick in it before presidential elections, though. There is.
I have two favorites. One is from Andy Biggs, reliably top five crazy pants in Congress from Arizona, who said, basically all bets are off. And the quote was, it's time to go an eye for an eye. I just love when people go for Old Testament.
I got to tell you, like Christians who, rely only on Old Testament law, come on, read the good news, people.
Although I think Andy Biggs might be a Mormon. You never know. Arizona.
They also, talk about Christ. So.
Nancy Mace called it
the covenants
death,
have
death
been
sentence.
Fulfilled.
I forgot that one too. Yeah.
Nancy the best Mace one said was from Clay Higgins of Louisiana, which is a real name and a real state, apparently. Sorry, Louisiana, I love you all. He tweeted out, "This is a perimeter probe from the oppressors." Mm. This is real, people. Hold, wow. Period. Our POTUS has this. Our POTUS is a commonly held phrase to refer to who the real POTUS is.
Wait, does that mean Biden or Trump?
Trump. Hold, okay. Our POTUS has this. Buckle up. 1/50K, know your bridges, rock steady, calm. That is all. That's the America we live in. And I just want to congratulate each and every one of us for contributing to where we are now. All right, we're going to get to our listener question of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, are you spending enough time on the person in the mirror? Is your life, work, family, relationship balance overwhelmingly about everybody else's needs and not enough about the person trying gamely to meet them? It's easy to get so caught up in your day-to-day responsibilities that you forget to focus on the person you have the most control over in your life, you. That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this very podcast. All you have to do to use this service is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, then start making yourself better equipped to help the ones you love. Stop feeling overburdened and unduly stressed, like the I-95 or Donald Trump's legal team. Just visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Barney Benner, which is totally his real name. BB writes, "Longtime listener, hope this hasn't already been covered. Seems like our populace and electorate is okay with opening up a new credit card on a regular basis to fund our government without thought on the ramifications. Eventually, the close your ears, Fred Young, shit will hit the fan. How do you each envision the event that will start the splatter?" Peter, why don't you start this one off?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a debt crisis. That's how this works. And we know what a debt crisis looks like. We've seen them now. A debt crisis in the United States is going to look a little bit different than it looks elsewhere because we borrow in our currency. That doesn't make me an MMT-er. It just is a different structural factor than, say, a country that borrows in a different currency. But it's going to be a debt crisis, and it's going to be when the people who loan us money, who loan the federal government money, say, maybe not. We're going to charge you more. I don't know, maybe we're going to go somewhere else with the money that we have to loan. And then all of this money that it takes to sort of keep the federal government going, to keep operations happening, it's not going to be there at some point. And the presumption right now in terms of our budget, the way it's structured, the way our spending and borrowing is structured, is that it will always be there. Well, that's always been true, but like eventually so we just went through this debt limit drama, and the whole thing was that it was going to be basically a debt crisis caused by Congress because Congress wouldn't lift the debt limit, right? That was the sort of the argument against what, well, here's why you got to raise the debt limit. But if you keep going like we're planning to go, like all of the scenarios say we're going to go, at some point it just happens regardless of what Congress does, because the people who loan us money say, I don't know, maybe not. And then there are huge problems because the government can't pay all of its bills, which is what was going to happen if we had not lifted the debt limit. So anyway, I think it's going to be kind of obvious. Like, I don't think it's going to be a crazy sci-fi scenario. I think it's going to be a pretty classic. The borrowing spigot maybe doesn't get turned off, but it becomes much more expensive to borrow. And it just throws a wrench into the whole machine.
Catherine, I want to hear about an event to cause this debt crisis. What do you have?
Yeah, my answer is absolutely the same as Peter's. Sorry. But I've said it before. I'll say it again. Lionel Shriver's The Mandibles is the most compelling portrait of this thing and how it might go down. I will say I looked up earlier today. The book is set in 2029. It was written in 2016. So, 2029 isn't a crazy guess for when the debt crisis starts. And in this particular scenario, there's basically a new global currency. The U.S. is excluded from it. We reset the national debt and all the gold belongs to the government. And then things get real, real bad. That's not exactly what will happen, but directionally correct, I think.
And also fun. Nick, do you have an event that will start the splatter?
Yeah, I think it's going to be when whatever White House intern uses a credit card that is no longer working to renew the registry for whitehouse.gov or congress.gov. And it's got to be a small, tiny event, right? You know, that yeah, we don't notice
butterfly.
Until it's too late. But I actually,
Buttle error?
I don't think it's going to be a debt crisis because, you know what, and I'll commend people to the current issue of Reason, which is mostly online, even for non-subscribers. But of course, people should subscribe so they can read the whole thing about Adam Smith turning 300. There's a great story about why Adam Smith matters by Vernon Smith. I interviewed Vernon Smith recently, and that podcast is up. But he talks about how what has happened over the past 20 years or so is that the Fed has just accommodated everything the government wants. We're not going to run out of money. We're not going to run out of credit. What has to happen is a political change. And for me, the event that is going to kickstart, hopefully, shit hitting the fan and then something better coming in its place is when Social Security benefits have to be cut or not when they have to be cut, but when Congress has to change the law. So because the Social Security program can only pay out stuff that's in their trust fund or money that they take in a given year through taxes. Sometime in the early 2030s, that is going to cut, that's going to run out, and they're going to have to cut benefits by 25% plus or minus 5%. That is going to occasion a major reckoning of the entitlement state, which is what is driving all of this. And we will have an absolute political freakout over what do you do. And I think that's when the reckoning starts. And it won't necessarily be a bad thing.
I'm going to.
So I thought about talking about entitlements, but I will just say that I think that it's that when we hit the trust funds become insolvent over the next decade, we are going to solve those and solve in air quotes with a magic asterisk. And it will just sort of look like it's done until a few years later or a decade later, at which point that stuff will sort of come home to roost. But I think we will actually get through the entitlement crisis with a bunch of political argument and discussion and we'll have many heated agreements on this podcast about it. But that's not going to be the thing that causes it. Or it's not going to be the thing that causes it right away. We will get through it. And all of the people on the left will be like, sure, all we need. Look, we did it. We just opened up the spending spigot and it worked and it's fine. And then in 2040, something will become not fine.
I
as
think
a result of having
the
done
rising
that.
Anger, much of it righteous against boomers, will be white hot in intensity in another 5 to 10 years. And that I think that the rising political class will be like, you know what? Let's make rich old people actually pay for their fucking retirement and health care. And that is going to be a major shift out of the New Deal era or the long 19th century, starting with Bismarck in Germany. The social welfare state, as we know it, is going to end, and it's going to be glorious, Matt.
Wow. I keep waiting for your 20th century to end, and now we got the 19th century in there. My bet, and I'm not sure that I believe that this is more likely than not, but I think it's kind of likely, and also I want to be hailed as a prophet later. That's going to happen soon. It's going to happen when it's going to begin to happen when the commercial real estate bubble pops, which has been threatening to do for quite some time. Something like $1.5 trillion worth of loans are coming due over the next 3 years. There's kind of no hope that they're going to get repaid. 40%, 50% or something like that look really, really dodgy. That stuff, it's a big market, $21 trillion market, and the vast majority of it is held by small and regional banks. Hey, class, what type of banks has been having some troubles lately? Small and regional banks. So people start demanding bailouts. There'll be bailouts until there kind of can't be bailouts anymore. I don't know how exactly that's going to go, but it's going to tilt towards constant bailouts all the time. But this is going to, I think, drive interest rates up, which is going to drive inflation up again after coming back down. And it's going to be a pretty bad little dual combo that will eventually start actually affecting things like the unemployment rate. And then all the other stuff that Nick and Peter and Catherine talked about will be on the accelerator. So look for it. I called it here. I don't know if I believe it, but I call it commercial real estate bubble. Over the next few months, it's the beginning of the end. I think we all just want apocalypse to happen one way or the other because it's more exciting.
Is that your Trump impersonation?
No, I would be using my hands like this if I was doing that. Yeah. All right. So the last time the United States Constitution was amended, Catherine was 11 years old and Peter was 10. We will actually talk about the 27th Amendment in a few moments. So try to contain your excitement. To amend the Constitution requires either a constitutional convention, good luck with that, or a two-thirds vote in both the Senate and the House on a proposal to then be sent to all 50 states. Good luck with that. Three-quarters of which would then need to ratify it. Good luck with that. The vast majority of amendments of the 27 amendments have been about protecting individual liberty from the encroachments of government, yet that hasn't stopped camera-hogging politicians from proposing brand new, totally unrealistic amendments to restrict personal freedom. Since it's presidential campaign season, as we've been talking about previously, that means it's also idiot constitutional amendment season as well. Peter, why don't you start us on a quick round of recent dumbass developments in the constitutional amendment space?
Yeah, so California Governor Gavin Newsom...
Enough said.
Once a constitutional amendment to impose a nationwide higher minimum age to buy a gun, plus universal background checks, a long waiting period for gun purchases, and a ban on what he refers to as the civilian purchase of assault weapons, which I'm sure he can explain what they are and why they're worse to you. Because all the politicians who want to do that, they're very good at explaining what they are and why they're worse. And it's not going to pass. It's a stunt. There's 13 states right now that have open carry of guns without a permit. You need three quarters of states to pass a constitutional amendment. Gavin Newsom might as well be proposing like a moon yogurt entitlement, just like pounds of moon yogurt for every family. It's exactly as realistic. He's so dumb.
I want moon yogurt. Catherine, it's not just Democrats, though, isn't it?
I mean, I'm moon yogurt. Okay. So I want to talk about another deeply stupid proposal, which is Vivek Ramaswamy's proposal to amend the Constitution to raise the voting age to 25 unless you serve in the military or as a first responder for 6 months or pass the same citizenship test that naturalized citizens have to pass. This is astonishing for many reasons, but one of my favorite things about this proposal is that it combines every single failed effort to constrain the franchise into a single proposal. Right. So he was like, what? I guess there's no poll tax. If he could like somehow bring a poll tax in here, then we would have all of them. But like, we already had a whole journey as a nation and then decided we weren't going to let people take tests to be allowed to vote. That's just not a good idea for a bunch of reasons. We're not going to do that. Shoveling everyone into some sort of backdoor, quasi-mandatory military service, also bad. I think a lot of this stems from this kind of meme in our culture right now that wants the age of adolescence to be extended eternally. And so you see these things like, you know, women who are 21 really shouldn't date men who are in their 40s because their brains aren't done developing. And, you know, like they shouldn't be allowed to work the register at a sex shop, you know, until they're 30 years old or whatever. And it's just absurd. Like, people become adults at age 18. We agreed on this. They get to vote. They shouldn't, as I have said many, many times. 18-year-olds are particularly low-information voters. Absolute garbage. But most voters are garbage. That is no reason to keep them from their constitutionally guaranteed rights. That is no reason to amend the Constitution to get us to a stupider equilibrium. We lowered the voting age to 18 when Matt Welsh was just a wee babe, and it should stay there.
Nick, before we hear about the 27th Amendment, what do you think are the chances that either Catherine or Peter know what the 27th Amendment is?
They probably looked it up, but I would say zero. Same as mine.
I looked it up.
I looked it up. Yeah.
I did know that the 26th was lowering the voting age for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Did not know it. When I heard that there was a constitutional amendment passed in 1992, I just couldn't even fathom what that might be.
I figured it had something to do with the designated hitter rule, or something. But the 27th Amendment, which passed in 92, says that Congress can't vote itself a pay raise. Yeah, it is a very good.
And I'm going to give them
the backstory is phenomenal because it had early origins in the early Republic era where it was floated around, but in like 1789, never made anything. And then a undergraduate student at University of Texas at Austin wrote a term paper about bringing it back. And that actually kickstarted the, the process by which it became in 1982. He did that. A decade later, it was passed, and it's kind of a great amendment. I want to go back, way, way ago and just make a quick pitch to say that in many ways, the need for amendments to the Constitution proves that the Constitution itself is not the, sanctified, whispered from God's ear into Madison's pen. Document that it was. I mean, just after a couple of years.
That was some Matt Welsh caliber nonsense that you just said.
I got it. I absolutely got it.
And it's like, there's no question that the First Amendment, more than anything else, is probably one of the reasons why 200 years after it was passed, we finally started approaching free speech in this country in the way that it was understood from about the late 50s until about 2 weeks ago. Which is good, but we shouldn't need amendments like this if the Constitution was up to the task of restraining government, which is a way of saying all of this is about the constant fight to restrain government from doing things that it shouldn't be doing because our rights pre-exist the government, and the government is there to enforce them, not to trample them.
My favorite example of constitutional amendmentry run amok took place when both Catherine Mangue Ward and Peter Sudeman were wearing diapers. Just hold that image in your mind.
Don't do that.
It's when 1982, Joe Biden, Joseph Robinette Biden II, voted to repeal Roe versus Wade. Voted on a constitutional amendment to repeal Roe versus Wade. And yes, that actually happened. It tells us a little bit about both the idiocy of constitutional amendment politics and also just how long Joe Biden has been gracing national life with his presence, and how if you look at basically any issue that you can think of, with the exception of maybe of Amtrak subsidies, he's been on all sides of the issue, probably at one time or another. And maybe we can get some other people to be in politics besides Joe Biden. Constitutional amendment stuff is very, very silly. And it should be, as first order, laughed at when proposed. And that includes highfalutin, nice sounding ones that you like. It's not going to happen, and probably shouldn't happen. And it's a sign that someone wants to get a press conference out of it. All right, let's go to our end of podcast. What we have been consuming in the cultural space. Peter Suderman, why don't you lead us off?
So Catherine mentioned failed efforts to constrain a franchise, which is a good segue for me. Because
The franchise, damn, please. Don't do it.
Because there's a new Transformers movie, Transformers Rise of the Beasts. It is the 7th live-action Transformers film, unlike the first 5. This is not directed by Michael Bay, which is disappointing. It means we don't get a robot peeing on John Turturro, or Stanley Tucci playing a very drunk Merlin, despondently slurring his words as he pleas, just desperate for help from a big three-headed robot dragon that he wants to come to his aid. None of that. Instead, this movie is set in the 1990s, and there's a surprisingly good hip-hop soundtrack. So if you're like into De La Soul or like old, you know, 90s hip-hop tracks, great. You love it. There are robots. Some of them turn into cars. Some of them turn into big animals. That's the title, Rise of the Beasts, right? One of them is a big giant robot ape named Optimus Primal. And he's voiced by Ron Perlman, which is, you know, got that gravelly voice.
Not
already.
Optimus Primate.
But it's a callback.
Optimus Primate was right
Beauty
there.
Beauty and the Beast.
So Optimus Prime, of course, is like the leader robot. He's the big semi-truck with flames on his side, you know, because you got to have flames on the guy. And this is just a reference to Optimus Prime, Optimus Primal. In fact, he says in the movie, he's like, oh, I named myself after you, the great leader. There's also a fast-talking, funny car robot voiced by Pete Davidson. So that's great, right? And there's a big planet-eating celestial body called Unicron. And in a sign of how far we've declined as a culture, Unicron is very sadly not voiced by Orson Welles, who famously, Orson Welles' final role as one of our great thespians was to voice Unicron in the 1980s animated Transformers movie. Ugh, just deserved an Oscar. Anyway, it's a movie about big robots, and if you like big robots, this is definitely the best big robot movie that's come out in at least a week.
Peter, would you say that you like big bots and you cannot lie?
Nick, hopefully Catherine's joke woke you up.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
No, we all need the little 25 cc's of D5W or whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, that was, I actually stepped into a cryogenic tank and just froze my fat during that.
Catherine, does this mean you're now on the side of efforts to constrain the franchise,
yeah,
the Transformers franchise?
I think I'm a dad
now.
Constrain
the franchise. I think we can make it a little more personal.
Go.
I read Self-Made, Creating Our Identities from Da Vinci to the Kardashians by Tara Isabella Burton. I'll also be doing a live taping of the Reason Interview podcast with her on Monday, June 26th in Manhattan. If people want to come to that, go to reason.com/events. Self-Made is a really interesting book that I'm going to, you know, pick some nits with, but it's about the moment, in the Renaissance, in the Enlightenment, and, you know, the modern period or the early modern period through contemporary times of when people started to recognize that God is dead and that we are the authors of our own destiny and all of the implications that come from that. It's a great book, and it's perfectly timed for the moment that we live in, where we need to make more sense, not just of the world, but who we are in it and who we want to be for however long before going on to the next thing. So I highly recommend Self-Made, Creating Our Identities from Da Vinci to the Kardashians.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I read the Unabomber's Manifesto. Just seemed like the thing to do. Obviously, he died this weekend, and there were many funeral notices of him. Also, today at the top of Reason.com, you can read Jerry Tuchilli's excellent piece on why the manifestos of the Nashville shooter and also the Christchurch guy should be made available to the public. That the notion that public officials can somehow protect us from the thoughts and words of people who have done horrific things for our own good is bound to backfire and is poisonous in a variety of ways. When the Unabomber was a thing, the manifesto was out and about. And of course, the joke at the time and in the years after was that if you pulled quotes from the Unabomber's manifesto and quotes from Al Gore, you could not tell who had written which one. But I will say, as I was reading it, I'm struck by how it's very clearly the work of someone who is totally deranged. And I don't know. I think over the years, there's been this kind of reconsideration and whatever of the Unabomber. But for example, article number 179 of the manifesto just says it would be better to dump the whole stinking system and take the consequences. That is the entirety of article 179 of the manifesto. It's you know, the thing that I was struck by as I was reading it was that any sane person reading this thing can tell it is the work of an insane person. And that sometimes we take secondary information or we kind of take in, you know, analysis and interpretation about important documents, and that reading them yourself is almost always fruitful. People can form their own conclusions. And I suspect that would be true of both the Nashville and Christchurch documents as well. So read the original source material, kids, even when it's the Unabomber's manifesto on the occasion of his death.
I also recommend...
Isn't it also just true that the sprawling sort of insanity of it lends itself to interpretation that, like, where people want to imbue this thing with power, right? And they want to use it to further whatever it is they're doing on their own. I mean, we've frankly seen this with some of Trump's more inscrutable statements, where he will just say something that's like, you can read six different things into it, and it's not even clear he knew what he meant. And then people are like, well, this just proves...
Yeah.
Whatever I already thought before.
I mean, Trump, you know, mostly doesn't finish sentences, which lends the sentences then to multiple interpretations. The Unabomber finished too many sentences, I would say.
The Unabomber also brought back the hoodie. Let's not forget. I mean, we're still living in the Unabomber's world.
Is the Unabomber responsible for the tennis shoes on telephone wires, or is that just purely... correlation,
I think.
Yeah, and I think he was against all telephones and sneakers, Matt Welch.
It's actually Wag the Dog.
Wasn't that a plot point in Wag the Dog?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Which I got wrong by calling it primary colors because I panicked in real time, Peter, but I did self-correct. I watched a movie, documentary, that I've been meaning to watch for several thousand years that was even recommended on a very recent email to this very... Roundtable podcast, by the way, roundtable@reason.com. And we like when you recommend that we look at stuff. And Catherine frequently does precisely that, particularly when she doesn't have any working legs. The one I watched was called The Wrecking Crew, Nick Gillespie.
I've watched it, Matt. It's great.
2008 documentary. Wrecking Crew refers to basically the architects, the studio musicians behind the West Coast sound in pop and rock music from essentially 1960 to 1975, more or less. A group of loose crew of 15, 20, 25 musicians. Hal Blaine, the drummer, is always central to the story. Carol Kaye, great bass player, Long Beach represent. These people they basically took from the beginning of Phil Spector's producing career, like He's a Rebel by the Crystals, all the way through Love Will Keep Us Together by Captain Antoniel. They kind of did everything. Since I'm stupid, it takes me a long time to realize that all the records I like sound a certain way that I love. And it's because, oh, look, either they have the same producer or they have the same musicians on them. So if you walk through it, it's going to be Beach Boys, especially when Brian Wilson took the mantle from Phil Spector, The Monkees, Sonny and Cher, Birds, Nick's favorite, Mamas and Papas, Frank and Nancy Sinatra. Simon and Garfunkel, on and on and on. They did all of it. The documentary is by Denny Tedesco, who is the son of Tommy Tedesco, who is one of the guitar players in this group. So was Glenn Campbell, by the way. And he's fetchingly portrayed in this documentary. It's more, I had read the book, The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret from 2012 by Kent Hartman. They're two pretty different. Obviously, the documentary gives you all the sweet music, or at least lots of it. And that's pretty cool. The Wrecking Crew book is much more kind of, even though it's anecdotal, it gives you a broader factual sweep of the group. This one is kind of more personal about Tommy Tedesco, who seems like a pretty fun character. And there's a couple of just like great star turns, particularly Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, who is, because it was a big like scandal that, oh, the Monkees didn't play their instruments. And he's like, come on, very funny about it. Leon Russell is also pretty funny, some other people, but really fun. If you're not familiar with the group, that's great. And then I would just recommend, even though I haven't seen documentaries besides, I think what's the one, Nick, it's like 10 feet or 20 feet from Stardom about backup singers.
Yeah.
Some of whom,
which is also great.
That's really great. Some of whom overlap with these recordings because it's all LA based, but there are similar super studio musician groups that affix to Motown, like the Funk Brothers and the Swampers in Memphis, the Muscle Shoals, not Memphis, Booker T and the MGs, the A-Team in Nashville. Fascinated by all those things. Really great. But this is The Wrecking Crew. Go check it out. All right. That's all the checkout time we have for here. We've already heard a pretty good tease from Nick Gillespie, so I'm not going to ask him what he's been doing. But you can see all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. You can see all the wonderful ways you can donate to our 501c three nonprofit at reason.com/donate, and we'll catch you next week. I won't, but Peter Suderman will. So you know what that means. Two words for you people:
segment titles.
God help you
franchise
all.
Choking.
What a strong handoff that was. Great work, everybody.
Goodbye.